91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Modern Florida is a place for renewal and possibilities for millions. So this hour we explore some of the minority pioneers who made their mark. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Since World War II, Florida has been a destination for people seeking new starts. Military veterans and their families flocked to Florida. The space program created exciting new jobs. Revolution created a huge Cuban-American population. And upheavals in South America and Haiti brought more people to the Sunshine State. We'll visit with University of South Florida professor and longtime journalist Dr. Susan McManus and learn more about Florida pioneers. She's written Florida's Minority Trailblazers, the men and women who changed the face of Florida government. First, a look at this hour's news. And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman on this holiday Monday. We observed this year's Martin Luther King Day with a twist, a program to celebrate the contribution of minorities and women who've been influential in Florida government since the 1960s. That's the period when Dr. King's influence was most powerful.
With us now is veteran journalist and political science professor, Dr. Susan McManus of the University of South Florida. She's an authority on Sunshine State political campaigns and elections, and she's compiled the definitive new tome about minority contributions to them.
It's called Florida's Minority Trailblazers, the men and women who changed the face of Florida government. And Dr. McManus joins us now from Land O'Lakes, Florida. We're going to learn more about Land O'Lakes today also. Welcome to you, Susan McManus.
Well, so happy to be here, and what a nice day for you to have me. My life's work of recent 20 years or so has been based on race and ethnic politics and gender, and this is just a really wonderful day to be on your program. So thank you for having me.
Thank you.
It's truly fascinating, this book, and to ponder how Florida's almost exponential growth in the last 50 years actually transformed the state in terms of its political composition, ethnically, racially, and by gender and party. Would you say that Florida is unique in this respect?
Our racial and ethnic diversity and the different countries of origin of people who live here or now in politics is really the most diverse in the whole country. And it's one of the reasons why Florida is such a focal point for parties and politicians and scholars to study our state. For example, even within the black community and in Southeast Florida, no better place that you've seen the influx of many blacks from Caribbean countries who have moved into politics at the local and state levels. And so you have more diversity within our black population than any other state. And the same absolutely is true of our Hispanic population in our state, coming from so many different countries and backgrounds. And of course, we haven't had a lot of Asians elected to office, but even there, of the two that have been elected to the state legislature, one had a Chinese background, the other Korean. So we are really the melting pot of the world's ethnicities in a way.
Your book covers from the 1960s on, but of course there were Hispanics in the Florida legislature before statehood, which of course was 1945, and also there were African American or black Americans in the legislature during Reconstruction, but we're really covering from the period of 62 or 3 on, correct?
Right, and one of the reasons that I selected the 60s forward is because that's the kind of politics that we're in right now, where it's one person, one vote. The 60s, the civil rights movement, of course, then followed by the women's movement of the 70s and influxes of large numbers of Hispanics from particularly Cuba in the late 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s, etc. But what we're operating under right now is the one person, one vote. Prior to that, in Florida history, you know, a North Florida county with 20,000 population would have the same number of people in the legislature as someone from Miami-Dade. And so the courts, the federal courts, intervened finally to dictate through a number of court rulings that it had to be one person, one vote, and that extended to the state legislature.
Susan, this book is really an accomplishment and an achievement. Why did you want to devote these last 10 years of your life to writing it?
I've been teaching Florida politics since I came back to Florida. I was born in Tampa. Actually, grew up in Pasco County. My family raised oranges, and my grandfather was an immigrant. And in teaching and in seeing the diversity that was occurring in the students in my class, I realized there really wasn't very good information biographically that I could use as examples in my teaching. And I hearken back to when it was that I got my degrees from the University of Michigan and then Florida State, my master's from Michigan, my PhD from FSU, that I observed that I had been reared, so to speak, in the quantitative era of political science, where everything was a formula, everything was a regression equation. You put numbers in a computer and you spit it out. And I realized as I grew older and mingled more with people and had diversity in my classroom that sheer numbers does not tell the story, and it surely does not tell the stories of people who were bold enough to run for an office that no one of their race or gender had ever held before. And so that really got me interested in it, my own search for materials to teach with. And then I got my students involved. I'm blessed to be able to work with a lot of students who have a passion about politics and race and ethnicity, so they were a stimulant over the years as well.
As a longtime student of Florida politics, I'm sure you would appreciate this, but to me, this almost represents something that the longtime clerk of the Florida legislature, Alan Morris, would be proud of, which is saying something.
I used a lot of his materials, the back of the book, and it is a pretty extensive book. It has the comprehensive list of all minorities who've served in any state office or congressional delegation from Florida. But the clerk's materials, I also have a chronology of major racial and ethnic and gender events, and that was taken right out of Alan Morris's handbooks. Mm. They were wonderful. I was reared on them. I'm honored that I'm even used in the same breath with him. But I will tell you that the clerk's office was fabulous in helping me track down some of the details that even after spending hours in the State Archives Library, I just couldn't put my hands on. And I'm particularly proud of the fact that they really helped me put in print all of the different kinds of plans that were considered between court cases and whatever about the formation of the legislature, the size of the chambers, and the redistricting and whatever. So it was really a massive effort. I'm glad it's done and very happy, as you might imagine. But I'm just hopeful that other people will find it very useful and very interesting to read. To me, the greatest stories of all were the ones told in the words of the trailblazers themselves, which was the purpose of it. I wanted their stories. They lived it. Let's tell others about how difficult it was, who made it easier, who had a mark on your formation as a person and as a legislator. And I can't tell you the joy, and even reading some of them again reminded me of visits, being invited into these trailblazers' homes, meeting their families, watching them get tears about remembering things. It was an emotional thing. And so the point I was trying to make a little bit earlier was I moved from just a straight-out quantitative political scientist, which I still love numbers, a lot of numbers in here, but I also understand you had to have qualitative research to put things in context. And, of course, now in academia, we have gotten to the point of where the quantitative and the qualitative have been merged in how you do really good research.
I was thinking, even in the case of, and we'll get to, of course, a lot of these trailblazers, but Leander Shaw, you interviewed him in April of 2014. He died in December of 2015. Did you feel a sense of urgency when you wrote this to get to as many of these people as you could before they passed?
I didn't really think of it like that, but two of them have now passed. Edmund Gong, who's another one, and Leander Shaw. I went to visit Leander Shaw in his daughter's home in Tallahassee, a very modest home, invited me in warmly, and she just sat me in the room, and we had great conversation, and every now and then he'd sort of hesitate a little bit, and she said, "Well, Daddy, don't you remember such and such?" And he would just then go forward with a lot. And I think that was just the most rewarding part of all of it was...
Speaking of Leander Shaw, yeah. Susan McManus, we just had former governor and Senator Bob Graham just walked by in our studios. He's a longtime friend of the program. And, of course, he appointed Leander Shaw.
Yeah, well, should we start with him? Shall we? He's the first.
And also, as far as trailblazers, a governor from Miami, the only one.
Oh, right, of course. And, of course, Bob Graham and Reuben Askew appointed a lot of the judicials and, you know, to these positions. Some of these justices were strictly a product of their appointments. And so, yes, and Bob Graham is absolutely, and Reuben Askew both, to be applauded for putting so many minorities in high places in Florida.
Well, shall we start with Leander Shaw? Because that was an incredible story. He was Florida's Supreme Court's first African-American male chief justice, but he was originally appointed in 1983 by Governor Graham, but then elected by his colleagues as chief justice in 1990. If you would talk about him and some of the extreme prejudice he faced when he started out.
He was a man of big stature, a very tall man, very, very impressive carriage. And he did grow up in an impoverished situation, as did all of these trailblazers. And he was from the Jacksonville area and did a lot of his early, well, first of all, he went to school at Howard, which is, as he said, was the hotbed of civil rights law at the time that he was going through school, so he really got a taste for it there. But when he was in Jacksonville and representing a lot of young blacks who were getting arrested and whatever, and he would be driving to St. Augustine on occasion, and one time he talked about Klansmen following cars and you know, often people just pointing out to him as, you know, this lawyer that didn't know anything, they'd come and look at him just like he was some sort of freak show in a way because they'd never seen a black lawyer. My favorite story that he was telling me was when he was trying to get some papers filed local people said, well, you can't file that kind of case here. And he immediately called Justice Jimmy Atkins, who was a Supreme Court justice at the time in Florida, and said, I know I'm a young lawyer. I'm not supposed to be calling you, but I've just tried to file these papers. I know this is right. What do I do? And the justice says, I can't tell you what to do, but I tell you what, you just call back down there in 10 minutes and see what's happening. And sure enough, in 10 minutes, they said, sure, you can file your papers. And then later, they both ended up on the court together. Talk about life's ironies. Mm-hmm. And so Justice Shaw asked Justice Atkins about that, and he says, well, you just had to, he said, I just made a call and said, really? He asked the clerk, he said, really? You mean you can't file this? What kind of place are you running? And that was the end of the story. But he had so many instances of where when Ed Austin, who was a public defender and state attorney, wanted to have Shaw serve as the head of his capital crimes division, you know, there was a lot of resistance about that too, or people would, you know, quietly come up and ask him after he'd gotten the appointment, do you need my help, insulting that this was this person who got this job just because of race or ethnicity. You know, there was a lot of embarrassing moments, but, you know, when all was said and done, he basically acknowledged that you know, it was a great place for him to be. He had been told early on, if you want to make an impact, do law. But I think one of the most fascinating cases that he talked to me about was the one, Provenzano is the name of the case, where it was challenging the use of the electric chair. And he submitted in his, I think, dissent, or I can't exactly remember what it was. But
it
anyway,
was. It was a dissent.
His dissent. He added some graphic colored pictures of an executed man who was in the electric chair and blood had run out and whatever. And it was the first time, to his knowledge, that he, and I guess mine too, that color photos had ever been used to make such a graphic point, sort of the beginning of the visual use of emotional photographs in the court of law. But these kinds of stories were just, you know, prevalent in almost every conversation I had with these trailblazers. It just was, I heard things that even after studying Florida politics my whole life, I just never heard anything like this at all.
We're speaking with Susan McManus. She's a distinguished university professor in the Department of Government and International Affairs at the University of South Florida, and of course, an author. And her latest book is Florida's Minority Trailblazers, The Men and Women Who Changed the Face of Florida Government. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Martin Luther King Day edition. We continue our conversation with Dr. Susan McManus. We're talking about her book, Florida's Minority Trailblazers. Susan, staying in the Florida Supreme Court and also staying with Governor Bob Graham appointees, 1985, Rosemary Barkett, the first female Supreme Court justice. Tell us more about her.
Well, she was often regarded in terms of race and ethnicity. I need to put a little bit of context. I defined a trailblazer as the intersection of a person's race and ethnicity, their gender, and also their party, because obviously party and race and gender are all mixed together to describe Florida's government. Well, Rosemary Barkett was initially often described as Florida's first Hispanic court member, because she had been born in Mexico. But, of course, she is definitely the first Syrian chief justice and justice. You know, her story was so interesting because she was the first woman chief justice and first woman on the bench and whatever. And she would often talk about how it was very collegial, that her colleagues seemed to be really working with her and looking out for her, and that they would actually make sure if she was single at the time, going to go somewhere, that they would make sure that she got there. You know, sort of the gentlemanly but not sexist way of dealing with her. One of my favorite stories. And this, I also met the person, the justice that this happened with. She was at some behind the scenes getting ready to go into a hearing and whatever, and she tripped on the rug and fell into the lap of one of the other justices. Huh. And someone snapped a photo, which the photo is in the book, and I do have a lot of photos. That was one of my favorite things, was to really comb for great photos telling their stories. And, you know, someone said, oh, no, you should never, ever have that picture. And she says, why, yes, of course we should share it, because it shows that we're people and, you know, that we can have fun, too. So I really, really enjoyed that part of her. Her background, she certainly was one who was very, from the beginning, tuned in to discrimination. She at one time was a nun, as you know. And when I was contacting her, because, as you know now, she's in the UN, you know, she's in international court, and when I called over there and spoke with her, it was amazing that she was just so touched that she would be included in this book. And I said, mm-hmm. Well, of course you would. So that's probably the most memorable things. I never got to personally interview her. A few select ones of these stories I had to rely upon either taped things that someone would have filed with the state library or some collections in other universities. But I did have that very nice conversation with her, and it was we relived the story that I just told you about, the fun that they had on the court and the collegiality. But she was unbending and unyielding when it came to fairness for women and minorities on the court.
Is that collegiality still there?
Well, I haven't been up there lately to the court. We don't hear a lot of divisiveness out of the Florida Supreme Court. Not like the U.S. Supreme Court, for example. But this was a time when things were changing rapidly, and she was on the court, and Leander was on the court, and things were really changing. And it was an exciting time to be on the court for them, because so much of what they were doing was really path-breaking, and they absolutely knew that. And as lawyers, they knew that legal decisions would be long-lasting and important in their impact.
Was she on with Leander Shaw for Bush v. Gore? Was she there for Bush v. Gore?
I am having trouble remembering that, okay. I'll be honest.
But Leander Shaw was.
Yes. Yeah, I have a picture of them in the book with the two of them together on the court at one time. She was a teacher as well, but born in Mexico and then ended up being naturalized as a citizen in Fort Pierce in 1958, just to give a little timeline to it.
I'd like you to spend some time on something that's really fascinating to me, and that I kick myself that I never got a chance to interview him, and he died not long ago, but that would be Edmund Gong of Miami. He entered the House in 1963, and that his Chinese-American family owned a grocery store in Overtown. It's a fascinating story.
It was, and this was another case. I was invited to the home, and he was getting up there, and he wasn't really well. Just one of the warmest experiences. I spent an entire afternoon with him, and I asked him, if he would mind if I taped the interview. I asked all of them that, and, of course, I let each of them read what we had written just to make sure of accuracy. A couple of times it was good because they would say, well, it really didn't happen then, or a different name. But his story was just, like you say, incredible, going all the way back to dynasties in China and great-grandfather and grandfather and then father coming to this country, in the laundry business. And it was when a time period when, they had these stiff collars. I wasn't alive. I only remember it, of course. And the laundries would really starch these collars, and because women didn't want to do it. And anyway, the laundry business. And when times started changing, the bottom line was that his dad was responsible for opening up markets in the black community in South Florida, in Miami, and when white vendors and grocers wouldn't go in there, he opened up these little markets, and Eddie, as they called him, Eddie Gong, worked in them as a child and learned Chinese, but also worked with reaching the black constituents. And he said in our conversations that it was always the case that the blacks in Miami were much more trusting of the Chinese than they were of whites. And there was sort of that pattern that we often see in minority politics of different minority groups kind of sticking together. But what was so moving to me about my interview was I had not been home very long when I got a call from his wife, wonderful woman who wrote for the Miami Herald for years, as did Gong briefly. And she says, you were told things by Eddie that his own children have never heard. Would you mind sharing the tape with our family? Now think of that. And I said, by all means, yes. And that was the kind of thing, again, that just kept me pushing as I was really trying so hard. It took a long time to get all these interviews. It was moments like this that I knew every story had an important element to the whole book and the whole picture of the transformation of Florida from a deep South segregationist white state to one of the most diverse in the country.
And Eddie Gong was a tremendous campaigner, is also being very intelligent. He had a scholarship to Harvard.
Right, and he loved talking about that, let me tell you. He did. He loved talking about it. And he was a very big believer in education as well. And he was still very, very active with the Harvard Alum Club and would try to go to gatherings when he could. He told me that. He was very, very proud of it. But the fact of him getting his start in Overtown in, you know, the heart of the Black community in South Florida, and seeing how being responsive to your customers. I love the story he told about his dad would even break open a pack of cigarettes and sell one for pennies if it meant that he could sell something to a customer and keep them back. And he did say that he learned that sort of salesmanship from his dad, and it really helped him when he went on the campaign trail. Mm-hmm. He also said that growing up in that kind of multi-ethnic community really helped him in high school because he was the only Asian, or one of a handful, ended up being class president, and a lot of it was because of his ability to sort of be able to reach people from all backgrounds. He's very jovial, very, very upbeat, just an incredible joy. And I love the way he also talked about serving in the legislature and the fact that he gave so much credit to some of the people that came in with his class. For example, he and Lawton Childs were in the legislature together. Of course, Childs ended up becoming one of Florida's governors and a very famous one. And he also came to the House right about the time that the civil rights movement was at peak, and he even mentioned that Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. So he really was one who is an example of the multi-ethnic and racial coalition building that you see is essential to the political successes of minorities who don't live in a majority-minority neighborhood where they can get more easily elected.
We're speaking with Dr. Susan McManus, Distinguished University Professor in the Department of Government and International Affairs at University of South Florida, about her latest book, Florida's Minority Trailblazers, The Men and Women Who Changed the Face of Florida Government. Professor McManus, before we go on with more trailblazers, which I would like to do, I thought we could just take a moment to look at the different ethnic and racial populations in Florida and how they've changed over these past 50 years. Beginning with the Hispanic population, which was almost exclusively Cuban back in the 60s.
And exclusively Republican for so many years. And a lot of that has to do with the immigration from the, you know, the overthrow, the Batista, the Castro, you know, the revolution, people moving, and then they're followed by the Mariel boat lift.
And the Bay
later,
of Pigs. The Bay of Pigs figured in
Bay of Pigs,
too.
Right. And so you see that the reasons that people came in the time period that different Cubans came to Florida also kind of affects some of their outlooks. But for the older generation of Cubans, there's still a sizable portion that are staunchly anti-Castro, even in spite of the normalization, still feel that things haven't changed a whole lot. But the younger Cubans are much more focused on domestic policy, leaning a bit more democratic than their elders. But it's now true that in Florida, and I'm speaking of elected voters, registered voters, that there are now more non-Cubans than Cubans. And wide variety. Puerto Ricans and Mexicans are the two largest, but we have sizable Colombian and Venezuelan and Nicaraguan populations. And their politics isn't always the same by any stretch. But we have seen, even among my trailblazers, I do divvy up. I described a first as someone coming from a background from a different country. So Anna Rivas Logan from South Florida, Republican, Nicaraguan. But you also had, some elected that were from Colombia. So we included country of origin as different countries as representative of the diversifying of Florida's Hispanic population. And the politics of the Hispanic population has changed dramatically. I'm an analyst for television in Tampa during an election season, and when I dealt a lot with the international press, as you might imagine, this last election, and so many would still have the idea that Florida's Hispanic population was universally Cuban and universally Republican, and I would certainly have to tell them differently. Of course, Floridians know it's different, but really fascinating how the whole racial and minority populations have diversified, and you can see that.
Susan McManus.
And who's elected.
Susan, I'd like to swing a little bit over to another trailblazer, and this one from the female side and also the Republican side. In 1972, the first woman was elected to statewide office. It was the Public Service Commission. It was Paula Hawkins, who, of course, later became the first female senator, U.S. senator, in 1980. Tell us a little bit more about her.
Well, she was not included in the book because she is not a racial minority, but she is often mentioned in the context, so that it took a very long time for another woman to win a statewide race. And but Paula Hawkins was a Republican activist, and a one-termer, but certainly was a pathbreaker for women in the U.S. Senate, but also women in Florida from the Senate, but especially Republican women.
Well, let's stay with women and go to Carrie Meek, who was the first African-American woman elected to the Florida State Senate and the first black lawmaker elected to Congress in the state of Florida, and that was 1992.
Right, and she actually was elected to the Florida legislature, but was not the first because you had, you know, others who were before
right.
her. But she was the first black woman elected to the Senate, and she's an educator. But they're fascinating, and before we get started a little bit on her bio, again here, I was invited to her home in Liberty City. She's elder, getting up there now, and it was very interesting because I was invited to go to her home with Corinne Brown. And, of course, the two, Corinne Brown and Carrie Meek, were the first two black women elected to the U.S. Congress ever from Florida. And they were very good friends in the legislature. So it was very moving to see the interaction between them. And their discussions were just incredibly detailed about both racism and sexism that they had experienced in both the legislature and also in the U.S. Congress. But Carrie Meek was fascinating because she graduated from college here in Florida, and at the time there was no provision for minorities. She graduated from A&M, Florida A&M, in 1946. But there was no way for her to go to a graduate program, and under Florida law, people like her who wanted to go forward, they would have their tuition and so forth paid by the state of Florida, but they could not go to a Florida university. I'm very proud to say that she chose my university, one of my alumni, the University of Michigan is where she got her master's degree. She was a teacher. She taught at Bethune-Cookman, became very close friends there with Mary Bethune, for whom the university is named. Always, always, always about education. Her whole life, it was a calling. And she got her start both from being an educator, well-respected within black community, but also within the church activism. This is a common theme you see with many, many of the early black trailblazers, especially the women, is that the church community played a large role in getting them elected. And after all, during the very discriminatory days, churches were often the refuge where blacks could talk about politics and people could come talk to them about politics without fear of, you know, personal dangers. And I was shocked because, and Corinne didn't even know this, when she was talking about, I'll never forget asking her how she felt when she first took the oath of office. That was often a question I would ask. I would say, when you put your hand up and you took the oath, what was the first thought that went through your mind? And I, frankly, this is one of the strongest women I've ever known, and she says, I felt in a way scared and a little bit overwhelmed and even afraid. And Corinne says, what? She says, yes. She says, my brother was killed in racial violence. And that was a pretty sobering moment in a conversation. It sort of gave me a feeling for starting at the very beginning and then going all the way through to really gain such a deep appreciation for all that she did for black women and the black community, not just in Florida, but nationally. Another thing I felt very interesting about her was she also said, I got a long way by not being a rabble-rouser, but being strong in my convictions and respectful of others. And I think that's one of the things that she said several times in the course of interviewing her, that she didn't back down. And you know, it was really interesting because people who know some of the characters in Florida politics, Dempsey Barron, you probably...
Of course.
And others, you know, turned out to be very helpful and respectful to her when she was trying to get things done. And then when she got to the Senate, she was put in, well, even in the House, a position of helping draw the redistricting lines that ended up helping her get elected. And she really respected that a white Southerner, male would put her in that kind of responsibility. But I've read many, many stories about her, and they all say that she was one of the most powerful legislators ever in her time.
And, of course, her son Kendrick, who, as you pointed out, holds the unique place in history that an African-American man succeeds his mother in Congress.
Right, and I interviewed him, too, and it was fascinating because he point-blank acknowledged, you know, without my mother leading the way, I wouldn't have gotten elected. And he said he always heeded her advice, but she didn't intrude on him much. But I thought it was really interesting because I asked her, I said, well, what was it like when your son Kendrick took your place in Congress? Because that was the first time that it ever happened. And I'll just quote her. She says, to say I was proud is not strong enough. It was more than that. God had something to do with this.
And, also,
and fate was a thread running through her whole story.
Also touch on Kendrick's relationship, rather curious relationship with Buddy McKay, of course, a longtime Florida Democratic political figure.
Yes. Well, Kendrick got his start, as you know, as in law enforcement and was off the highway patrol and was often the person the aide that would take the lieutenant governor around. And I was stunned because I asked every one of these trailblazers who made a lot of impact on you, who helped you along the way, whatever. And I, of course, he talked about his mother in a different way in the campaigning, but he says, in terms of teaching me about politics and how government runs, he says there was nobody better than Buddy McKay.
Yeah, I knew,
so
I knew Buddy. He was a terrific public servant, indeed.
We're speaking with Dr. Susan McManus about her latest book, Florida's Minority Trailblazers, The Men and Women Who Changed the Face of Florida Government. A break, and we'll be right back.
It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman with you on this Martin Luther King holiday. If you're off today, we certainly hope you're having a nice day. And we're visiting with journalist and political science professor Dr. Susan McManus. She's the author of a tome called Florida's Minority Trailblazers, The Men and Women Who Changed the Face of Florida Government. It's a really valuable reference work for people interested in Florida politics and government and journalists. And Susan, I'd like to touch a little bit on someone. When I first came to the Miami area in 1974, I was surprised that this area with such a huge Cuban population had a mayor. The city of Miami had a mayor of Puerto Rican descent, and that would be Maurice Ferre, who is still active in politics here. Tell us a little bit more about him.
Right, and I did see him recently. He's still very active and still talking a lot about his background. Yes, he, you know, didn't serve a long time in the legislature because the position of mayor of Miami came open, and he quickly ran for that and became the first Hispanic mayor of a big city in the country. So, I mean, that was really very interesting. A feisty gentleman. I did not get to meet him, to interview him personally. He was having some health issues and at the time, or was out of the country, I can't remember which. So I would communicate with him. He would send me his answers to things by email, which several did. And often talked about the fact that the Puerto Rican dimension wasn't really emphasized that much. He didn't really stress that too much. Obviously, as you say, being sort of a Cuban area, but he also had a Cuban relatives as well. So I think that that is one of the reasons, is that he was born in Puerto Rico, but he had Cuban relatives as well, which made things a little bit easier in terms of campaigning.
He's run
Democrat.
He's run unsuccessfully a few times, but also served on the Miami-Dade Commission for a long time.
Right. Yeah. He did. Right. And so it was one of those situations of where he just decided he was going to take a run at it. He loved public service. He liked people. And had an eye all along for local type problems, where it was something that fascinated Maury, because at the time that he took office and was running, it was really the bursting moment for, not that Miami slowed down much at all in terms of growth, but it was really a takeoff period for the population, and it was diversifying by the moment. And so
to show how things have changed, Susan, I remember when he was mayor, one of his big issues, as the city of Miami had just gotten cable TV, and he had this major campaign, oddly enough, to keep the Playboy channel off of the city of Miami cable television. That was a big issue.
Well, of course, Catholicism is a deep part of, interwoven with a lot of Hispanic politics, so I understand that.
Well, let's move on to Ileana Ross Leighton. She
okay.
has so many firsts. First Cuban woman to serve in the Florida House of Representatives, that was 1982. The first Cuban to serve in the Florida Senate, 1986. First Cuban American and first Hispanic woman to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives in 1989. So, if you would, just talk about her.
And just trying to keep up with all her elections took me a while to track down all that, because one of the aspects of this book is we actually have the election results, primary and general, of people who were these pathbreakers. Sometimes we tend to overlook the fact that they did have to win, and that some of these were very, very close. Well, she was eight years old when she came to the U.S. from Cuba, and her family, of course, left there because of the uproar that was going on, and so she ended up going to college here and entering the education world. But she said as a child, when she first came here, she was young, and she was thrust into school, and, she couldn't speak English, and she didn't know the subject, and trying to do both of them, she said, it was really, really difficult. And she said that actually her family best learned English, and this is not unusual either, by watching television. And as she said, it was homework for her. I guess some kids would like to have that reason for watching television today.
Yeah.
But from the beginning, she loved education, always has. And she went to FIU and then the University of Miami for a doctorate, representing a kind of a country of origin district when she first ran for the House. And, she was there at the time when things change from the multi-member to single-member district. Well, the bottom line is, in school and around the dinner table, they did talk politics. And this is one of the things that we know. People who become interested in politics from their youth often hear very lively discussions about politics at the dinner table. Less true today because families don't eat together as much. But it was certainly true when I was growing up. My family disagreed on everything at the dinner table, and it was very engaging, and I love politics. But really, I think the interesting thing about her was that she used her knowledge of education and her passion for education and her knowledge of people and communities through schools and whatever to run for office. And she was very successful in winning in both the state house and the state senate, as you pointed out. And then she took a real gamble, and this often happens too. She ran when Congressman Claude Pepper, well-known Democrat, aging expert, respected everywhere, died. They left an open congressional seat, and she took a stab at it and beat out a lot of people. But in that, in the course of campaigning for some of that, she pointed out that her opponents would often use language like Americans favor this or something like it. This is the American seat, inferring that she wasn't qualified, and it was sort of clearly an anti-Hispanic logo that was a slogan that was being used by her opponent. And of course, the night she won, and she only won by 6%, you had a lot of people from her community coming and screaming in the streets, as they love to do, Viva la Cuban, you know. Mm-hmm. But the really funny thing there too was she didn't realize she was the first. And as you know, Katie Couric called her from the Today Show the morning after she ran and said, "How's it feel to be the first Hispanic woman elected to Congress?" She didn't even know she was. But I've interviewed her many times. I went to Washington. Her whole office just looks like a history. It's almost chronologically. You could go through and see her career. You could just rewrite the Cuban history and Hispanic history of Florida through the eyes of the photographs in her office. But I think one of the things that's also understandable from her education background and the multi-ethnic nature of Miami-Dade Community College is the fact that she has been able to win as her district has continued to get more, slightly more Democratic. And she has always been very supportive of the LGBT community. And that's unusual for a Republican. But that, her inclusiveness of Hispanics from all different backgrounds and other races and cultures coming from her days as an educator, and her sort of more, I'd say, inclusiveness of differences of backgrounds,
including her
really helped her a lot.
Including supporting her transgendered son.
Yes, and that's really, I think, helped her a lot. It's made her stand out. But when you talk to her about what kind of legislation she's really interested in, of course, she was chair of the Foreign Relations Committee in Kent Senate, the only woman there, Hispanic woman, to do that as well. She's still very, very interested in Cuba, but her passion truly is education. And she has had a lot of very famous interns. I mean, Marco Rubio interned in her office, and she says she loves to have student interns. In fact, one of my very best students of late, a young woman from very rural Kentucky, just served as her intern, and they just say she's fabulous at teaching others about politics.
Well,
this hour's flown by.
Yeah, it has, and we so wanted to ask you about the election of 2016, but we'll have to, unfortunately, we don't have the time to do that now. I wish we did. Dr. Susan McManus is Distinguished University Professor in the Department of Government and International Affairs at the University of South Florida and an author. She is one of the nation's best-known authorities on campaigns and elections, having served as the chair of the Florida Elections Commission and as an advisor to the Florida Division of Elections. Her latest book that we've been discussing, and it is so worth getting if you want to know about Florida politics, is Florida's Minority Trailblazers, the Men and Women Who Changed the Face of Florida Government.
The University Press of Florida.
University Press of Florida. And we thank you so much, Susan McManus, and best of luck on your election book that you're writing.
Well, thank you for having me. It was truly an honor and a pleasure.
It was our pleasure.
Thank you. And that wraps up today's holiday edition of Topical Currents. It was engineered by social media coordinator Jason Zapka and produced by Richard Ives. Polly Landis is associate producer. As always, if you'd like to hear the whole program or link it to a friend, there's free audio archives at our website, WLRN.org. Also, we have the iTunes podcast as well as the Topical Currents Facebook page with links, photos. Drop us a like. And tomorrow's guest is South Florida-based journalist Brett Sokol, the arts editor of Ocean Drive magazine. We'll get his take on the state of the arts here in South Florida, and of course, much more. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, as always, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.